duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Wow, how's it going, everybody? Welcome to THC, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm the man who calls himself the Carlwood. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tweeting, liking, and reviewing the show. You're all bona fide pimps, and I salute you for it. I'm moving some of the pieces around on THC, so I'm going to drop on you everyone's favorite ad for Conspiraties, my attempt to bring the conspiracy perspective out into the open, into the world, a bold fashion. It's also the best way to keep me alive, supporting that little venture. So here's that, and on the other side, we'll be talking to Trevor Aronson about his new book, Terror Factory: Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Boom.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the Brave Roof tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Hireside Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Folks, it has been over a decade since the suspicious tragedy of 9/11, and it's hard for even the most conventional of patriots to argue that our response hasn't been, at very least, a bit overblown. Yeah, we've invaded numerous countries, ruined more lives than can be counted, overthrown unconnected governments, hung unaffiliated leaders, spent trillions of dollars on corporate weaponry, groped and degraded millions of innocent travelers, confiscated hundreds of thousands of bottles of cologne and hair gel, accepted the invasion of our privacy, and invited our streamlined indefinite detention. Folks, it would seem excessive even without the looming doubt of the official story. Unfortunately, the culture of fear stemming from that single day has done damage to this world that will last generations, a fact that hits home much harder when you realize the majority of the paranoia-causing terror plots over the past 10 years have not been planned in some foreign cave in the sand, but instead by overeager agents in FBI cubicles. Today's guest, Trevor Aronson, is here to walk us through just such a realization with his new book, The Terror Factory: Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Trevor is a winner of over 24 awards in journalism, and his trajectory is looking stronger than ever. You've seen him on Democracy Now!, Russia Times, and This American Life, and I'm happy to welcome him here to THC. Trevor, how's it going?
Great, great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. Wow, what a great book, man. I commend your work in such a taboo area. Making a career out of government criticism seems to be riskier and riskier these days.
I think we do see, you know, there's a, especially after 9/11, there was a real skepticism of the press, or I'm sorry, unwillingness by the press to really be skeptical of these, you know, types of cases and the FBI's counterterrorism program in general.
Right. And so to kick it off, in the intro I ran through quite a few of the negative consequences due to the war on terror. Now, most tried and true patriots would respond by saying everything the government is doing is justified because we've had no attacks since. But would you say that's a naive way of looking at it?
I do think it's naive. You know, it's true that we haven't had any attacks. I mean, there have been a couple of close calls. You know, I don't make the case in the book that there aren't terrorists at all. I mean, if you look at Najib al-Azazi, you know, he came close to bombing the New York subway system in 2009, and Faisal Shahzad failed in his attempt to bomb Times Square in 2010. But, you know, the majority of cases that the Department of Justice and the FBI have brought into federal court for terrorism charges since 9/11 haven't been like Najib al-Azazi and Faisal Shahzad. Instead, they've been you know, what I would consider people on the fringes of society that are economically desperate or in some cases mentally ill, who get caught up in a sting operation involving an FBI informant who offers them all the means and opportunity they need to commit an act of terrorism. You know, what the FBI fears today is not this trained, well-organized cell of terrorists like we saw at 9/11 or like we see in other parts of the world. What they really fear is someone who they consider a lone wolf, someone here in the United States who, you know, doesn't have a specific connection to Al-Qaeda, but, you know, becomes inspired through Al-Qaeda jihadi videos and extremist message boards to commit some sort of act of terrorism. And so these sting operations are intended to lure these people out, to find the people who are on that line, you know, as an FBI agent says, you know, about to cross over from sympathizer to operator. And they do that by inserting informants and undercover agents and, you know, buddying them up, so to speak, to people who say they want to commit an act of terrorism, and then providing all the means necessary, the logistical means, sometimes the idea itself. In almost every case, they provide the bomb and the weapons. And so most of these people who are prosecuted on terrorism charges and who the federal government puts forward in press conferences as being a dangerous terrorist who was about to strike never have the capacity on their own for terrorism. In most cases, they never had weapons of their own. In most cases, they had very little money. And so it's hard to believe that on their own they would have become terrorists, but through these elaborate sting operations, the FBI is able to kind of overnight transform them into someone that the public starts to believe is a dangerous terrorist.
Right. And some of these stories are more shocking than others. You know, the range is pretty wide on how, you know, susceptible to terrorism the Patsy really is. But run us through these numbers, because the book says there's been about 508 people charged with having terrorist plans since 9/11. What percentage of these, quote, foiled plots could be considered in some way FBI manufactured?
Right. So there's been, in the decade after 9/11, there were a little over 500 defendants in terrorism cases. And of those 500, about half were involving informants. So in some cases, the informant acted as you might suspect. He provided information to the FBI. But in other cases, in more than 150 cases, the informant acts as almost as an agent provocateur. He provides, he plays a role in the sting operation. In some cases, he provides the idea. In other cases, he provides the means. And in these sting operations, there's never anyone, you know, by themselves who's capable of terrorism. It's always the FBI informant or the undercover agent who make that terrorism possible. You know, a good example of this is a case that became well known outside New York City, known as the Newburgh Four. And these were four African-American converts to Islam. And thanks to a very aggressive informant, they engaged in this plot to bomb synagogues in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that the lead defendant on the case was a Walmart stalker who had a history of mental illness, had no money on his own, and it was the informant who ultimately provided everything they needed. He provided the transportation because they didn't have cars. He provided the money they needed to build the bomb making, to buy the bomb making material. He provided the know-how to build the bombs, and then all the defendants had to do was just place the bombs in front of the synagogues, which they did. But on their own, these are guys that were on the fringes of society. I mean, they had no interest in, you know, no ability to commit terrorism on their own. And in addition to the informant providing all of the means, he also offered a number of inducements. You know, he offered the men $250,000 if they carried forward in the plot. And, you know, to the lead defendant, he offered to buy him a barber shop. And so, you know, that's a case that FBI Director Robert Mueller has cited repeatedly to Congress as an example of the FBI thwarting an impending terrorist attack. But in truth, that attack was only made possible through this elaborate sting operation where the FBI basically empowered a group of losers to, you know, overnight become terrorists.
Right. I mean, in some of these cases, you got an informant who is paid by the FBI per terrorist, I guess. And, you know, they're finding people who are kind of online just running their mouth that have mental problems and no money. And then they're stringing them along, offering them money to do it, and then saying, hey, guys, get this guy. I got one. Put the check in the bank.
Exactly. You know, and I think that's one of the most fascinating parts about this story, I think. Because, you know, this story ultimately is a story about terrorism, but it's also a story about, you know, justice and the fairness of justice in the United States and the administration of that justice. And, you know, what's particularly disturbing, I think, is that so many of these informants involved in these sting operations have a financial interest in the prosecution. You know, they will get paid if they find someone who, you know, they can portray as a terrorist in a sting operation. And they can be paid handsome sums. You know, some of these informants make $100,000 or more per case. And so when you have that kind of incentive where, you know, if you can go out and find someone who says they want to commit an act of terrorism and bring them along on the plot, there's going to be a lot of money waiting for you for it at the end. You know, that creates a recipe where you're going to have a lot of these cases, because
yes,
the informant is going to be very aggressive in finding people who are susceptible, who are easily influenced, and then guide them along in a process, you know, that's part of a sting operation where, you know, from day one they had little capacity, and by day 90, you know, they have a bomb in a storage unit and they're ready and willing to deliver it with the informant.
It is crazy. And one of the most shocking stories in the book to me about someone becoming a patsy in a terror plot was the story of the Albany pizza man, Mohammed Hossein. Walk us through that case a little bit so folks can better understand how this happens to people.
Right. So the FBI was interested in this man who was a local imam in Albany, New York, named Yassin Aref. And they needed to find a way to get to him. And so they ended up targeting this local pizzeria owner named Mohammed Hossein. And the FBI used this very aggressive informant named Shahed Hussein. And the names can be confusing because they're both similar. But in this case, Mohammed Hossein, you know, was going about his life. He'd actually built a nice life for himself in the United States. He had several rental properties, a successful pizzeria. He cared for his whole family as well as his mentally disabled brother. And the FBI chose to target him because they wanted to get closer to the imam, and Mohammed Hossein was a very devout Muslim and was active in the local mosque. And they devised this plot where they were going to loan to Mohammed Hossein money that he needed to repair some boilers at a rental property that he had. Mm-hmm. And essentially the FBI informant told Mohammed Hossein, well, you know, I've got this money coming in. I'm an importer-exporter from China, and, you know, I've got to move this $50,000. I'll give you $50,000 if you'll, you know, pay it back to me over time. And so they agreed to do that. What the FBI knew was that Mohammed Hossein, being a very devout Muslim, would want a Muslim religious leader to oversee the transaction, which is customary in Islam, and just to make sure that the financial transaction meets religious standards. And so the FBI undercover agent says to Mohammed Hossein, well, you know, I don't want an Indian and I don't want a Pakistani overseeing this. And he said that for a very specific reason, which was that only left one other local Muslim religious leader in town, and that was Yassin Aref, who was an Iraqi, and a Kurdish Iraqi. And so Yassin Aref is brought in to oversee this financial transaction, and during the financial transaction, the FBI informant holds up a trigger device for a missile, which is really hard to tell if it's a trigger device. It looks like an oversized label maker, and he's saying things about Mujahideen and making a number of comments that are somewhat nonsensical at times. But that was enough for the FBI to build a case around both of them for money laundering, for supporting terrorism. And Yassin Aref was convicted, as was Mohammed Hossein, and Mohammed Hossein is serving, I believe, 15 years in prison. But this is a guy who never had any specific connection to terrorism.
Right.
The evidence suggested that it was very unlikely that he realized the money he was funneling was supposed to be related at all to terrorism. There was a rather odd moment where the FBI informant shows Mohammed Hossein a surface-to-air missile, but then tells him later that, you know, he's an importer-exporter and he knows an FBI agent and it's all legitimate. And so Mohammed Hossein was left with the impression that, well, that's weird that he was importing weapons, but, you know, he tells me he knows an FBI agent, he tells me it's legitimate, you know, there is a legitimate business in importing and exporting weapons. And, you know, this was a case that largely outraged the community in Albany, but it was enough to get both of them, you know, convicted. And neither of these men were at all involved in any plot that was imminent in any, you know, terrorism organization that posed any sort of threat to the United States. You know, the only connection to terrorism was a rather distant connection for Yassin Aref, where allegedly in Iraq they found a list of names for a group, and Yassin Aref's name was on that. But that was all the government really had, and that's all they've been able to release publicly. Yet they were still able to get convictions for both of these men.
Yeah, it is really sad, because the guy is just working in his pizza shop. An informant shows up. He's giving toys to his kids. He's telling him he can get his mentally challenged brother an ID card. And he's just injecting himself into this man's life. He didn't seek him out. And, you know, then he's like, oh, well, you need a loan, man? Well, I can help you out. And I guess he kind of thought, because of the religious connection, like, maybe that's why he's being so nice. He's got the extra money. But, you know, to just be turned around and thrown in jail for 15 years, you know, a lot of people think, oh, this can't happen to me. And I'm sure there's also a little bit of a culture of racism when it comes to the prosecution, but, you know, it's not that far off from just happening to anyone that they decide to throw into that plot.
And it's certainly worth noting that the evidence suggested that the informant they used in targeting Mohammad Hossein was a far worse criminal than Mohammad Hossein ever could have been. You know, the informant, Shahed Hussein, was accused of murder in Pakistan and fled the country. He was then running a DMV scam where he had several people who worked at the DMV. He helped a number of immigrants get driver's licenses that were fraudulent so they could use them to become cab drivers in New York. There's evidence that while he was declaring bankruptcy, he didn't declare to the court $500,000 he had in an overseas account. You know, all types of things that, you know, are criminal. And he was able to escape those criminal charges because he agreed to work as an informant for the FBI and then ultimately, you know, hounded Mohammad Hossein as part of this case. And, you know, now Shahed Hussein has continued to work with the FBI. He makes $100,000 or more per case and moves from case to case and, you know, has both an economic incentive because he can make a lot of money with the FBI, but also a kind of a punitive one, you know, that as long as he works for the FBI, he doesn't have to worry about facing any criminal charges for what he's done in the past.
Yeah, and you call him in the book, you call him the super informant, and he is such an asshole because, you know, he has a culture of doing this to people for his paycheck. And obviously you said he, you know, the guy is a worse criminal than anyone, than most of the people he's getting mixed up in these plots. He's just a guy hungry for money, and he found a way to get it.
Absolutely, yeah. One of the things I was going to mention, as I mentioned in the book, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, informants are not nice guys. They're usually, you know, in some cases worse than the people they target. You know, Stephen Trott, who's a judge and the district court appellate judge in the federal level, calls, you know, informants sociopaths. And I think that's a great description.
Yes.
For them, because, you know, they have to basically do what most people would hate, which is that they have to go and every day lie to someone. And then over months and even years, build up an intense relationship, a great friendship with someone, and then be willing to turn on that person, you know, and,
right,
and send that person to jail for decades. And I don't think that's something that anyone other than a sociopath could really do in good conscience.
Right. And it doesn't always end well. I mean, if you ever seen Bulletproof, you know that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ultimately the FBI, you know, it's important to note, like, in using these informants, the good ones are never going to be good guys, you know. So ultimately,
right,
Almost every one of these informants has some kind of baggage. You know, the FBI in many of these sting operations has used criminals. They've included, you know, drug dealers. In one case, it included a man who was wanted in Albania for shooting someone. In another case, it included a child molester. You know, the FBI is willing to use just about anyone as an informant, which really raises a question. You know, like, are we really, are we using people who are worse than the people we're targeting? You know, are we using bigger fish to catch smaller ones, essentially?
Right. Another point about Mohammad Hussein was, you know, he said to you when you visited him in jail, his kids are now without a father, growing up without guidance. That's the kind of action that creates someone who wants to do damage to this government. Taking away someone's father, you know? You're going to want revenge for that. Not necessarily that his kids do, but we have to be careful of, like, what we're doing to people. These are real lives.
It's a good point to raise, because it really raises a question of blowback. You know, what ultimately will happen as an unintended consequence of these policies. You know, and certainly some of these men that we're sending away for 15, 25, 35 years, you know, that were caught up in a sting operation on their own, unable to commit acts of terrorism, you know, it's not unreasonable to ask whether upon their release from jail in their 40s and their 50s, they will be so angry that they will actually become terrorists that on their own 25 years ago they never could have become. And I mean, I think that is one of the things that will be really interesting to see.
And let's look at the other side of informants, because there's the criminal informants, but there's also a lot of intimidation and blackmailing that goes into creating unwilling informants in the Muslim community while using some type of various leverage to pressure them into finding something just to get the heat off of them.
Right. You know, the best thing to compare this to in some ways, but it's important to compare it to because it's so different, is how the FBI investigated, you know, organized crime in the 80s, for example, like when they were going after the Italian mafia organizations. In those cases, the way they recruited informants was they looked for people who were, you know, the lower level mafia soldiers who were committing crimes, minor ones, like, you know, stealing a car. And then you get that guy, you bust him for stealing a car, and you say to him, you know, if you work with us, we can make that stolen car theft charge go away. and you can, you know, have to work with us as an informant. And that's how they recruited these informants. Well, if you're recruiting in the Muslim community, it's a lot different than recruiting from within an organized crime organization. You know, in these cases, you know, these are people who are law-abiding people going about their day, working everyday jobs, going to the mosque on Friday. You know, you're not going to catch them stealing cars. And so in this case, the FBI needs to build up its capacity for intelligence in Muslim communities. And it does that by using what leverage it can. And in the Muslim community, immigration tends to be the greatest form of leverage.
Right.
So what we see is, and what we've seen in a number of cases, is the FBI working very closely with ICE, using immigration and the threat of deportation as leverage to recruit informants. You know, so these are people who didn't violate any laws. If they were facing possible deportation, that's a civil issue, not a criminal one. And in these cases, the FBI uses that to say, well, you know, unless you work with us, you're gonna, you know, have to be deported. Or they'll say, hey, you know, we know you're looking to get your family over from Syria. If you work with us, we'll make that happen. If you don't, they probably won't be able to come over. And that's an extraordinary form of leverage that the FBI is able to use, and it's been incredibly effective. You know, today the FBI has 15,000 informants who are working for it. It's just 10 times as many as it had under Hoover. And, you know, some of these informants are, like I mentioned, Shahed Hussein, who was a criminal who, you know, plays as an agent provocateur in these sting operations. Others are providing information under duress, you know, acting in sting operations under duress as a result of these immigration threats.
You know, to point out another one of his methods that really does, because I'm sure some people are like, well, you know, it's got to be pretty tough to get mixed up in a terror plot, but it really isn't. I mean, it even came out in court that he uses code words for missiles that he makes up that only he knows, that the person he's talking to doesn't know. He called it a Chaudhry. Like, oh,
yeah.
I'm transporting some Chaudhrys. And the guy's just like, okay, whatever. Like, you're going to give me $50,000. Like, you know, and he was paying him back, too. It's just, it's so unfortunate.
Right. In the memo line there, when he was paying them back, he put, you know, loan repayment. You know, there was certainly evidence to suggest he thought it was a loan. There was very little evidence to support the idea that the two defendants, Mohammed Hossein and Yassin Aref, knew what Chaudhry meant. You know, it was clear that he was using that word, but it was unclear that they even knew what Chaudhry meant. And, you know, it also fit a pattern, too. You know, later, Shahed Hussein, that same informant, was used in this Newberg case that I mentioned earlier, where these men were plotting to bomb synagogues in the Bronx. And in that case, during trial testimony, it came out because on one of the recordings, Shahed Hussein offers the men $250,000 to carry forward with the plot. And obviously that looks very bad on the government side. You know, you're basically offering, you know, bribing someone to go forward in a sting operation.
Yeah.
And Shahed Hussein says, well, that was a code word. And the defense attorney asked him, well, who knew that code word? And Shahed Hussein had to admit, well, he was the only one who knew that code word. And so obviously it's not much of a code word if you're the only one who knows it. And, you know, it was clear in both of these cases that Shahed Hussein was doing and saying things, whatever he needed to do to make a prosecutable case.
That, to me, that specific case was the most shocking. But digging through all these documents and cases yourself, what did you find most troubling or surprising?
You know, in some of these cases, what I found troubling was the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, that they used people who were worse than the people they were targeting. You know, for example, Seattle, they used that child molester who ultimately targeted two men who were mentally ill. One of them had schizoaffective disorder, which means he had trouble distinguishing between reality and fantasy, which obviously is someone who is going to be very susceptible to the influence of an informant.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cases, you know, what I found so shocking was just how little the capacity was. You know, one of my favorite cases, for lack of a better term, is this man named Derek Sharif. And, you know, Derek was this guy who lived in Illinois, and he had recently converted to Islam, and his parents and his family had ostracized him for it. And he was working at this video game store, didn't have a place to live, and his car had just broken down. So Derek was in, like, the worst possible situation you could possibly be. And an informant comes to the video game store and says, hey, yeah, I know you know, you don't have a place to live. Your car is broken down. Why don't you live with me? You can use my car. You know, I've got food. You can just stay with me. And Derek, you know, because it was the day before Ramadan, thinks this is a sign from God and goes and lives with this informant. And over the course of months, the informant encourages him to move forward in a plot to attack a shopping mall. And this was an idea that the informant came up with. And so they talk about it, and Derek is saying some pretty hateful, odious things. But the problem for the FBI's case was that they needed what's called an overt action. They had to get him doing something that was more than just talking about it. And so they decided, well, let's see if we can get him to buy grenades for the attack. But the big problem for the FBI was that Derek was flat broke. He didn't have any money. And so the informant says to him, well, you've got these old stereo speakers, right? Like, what if we took this to the arms dealer, and I think if we took it to him and said, hey, we'll give you the stereo speakers, and you'll give us the five grenades, he'll say fair trade. And, you know, of course, it's ridiculous on its face. You know, I don't know a lot about black market arms dealing, but I don't think an arms dealer is going to accept two ratty old stereo speakers for
no.
black market
No, you need at least
grenades.
Four.
Right. And so they end up going to the shopping mall, and Derek brings his two stereo speakers and hands them over to this undercover agent who's posing as an arms dealer, and the undercover agent hands him back the grenades, and the FBI rushes in and arrests him, and ultimately he's convicted of conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction and is now serving 25 years in prison. Well, obviously, you know, Derek Sharif on his own with his two spare old stereo speakers never could have obtained the grenades, never would have been able to move forward in a plot like this. And so what I find most disturbing is are cases like that where ultimately, men like Derek Sharif are convicted and sentenced according to sentencing guidelines that were designed for true, capable terrorists. So the FBI, by empowering him, by giving him access to these grenades, ultimately puts him under sentencing guidelines that on his own he never could have committed a crime that would put him there. And so, you know, to me that's a great example of the FBI really just empowering someone to become a terrorist who, on his own, you know, was probably incapable of even minor crimes.
Right. And in regards to some of the misguided youth and mentally unstable, there's a comment in the book made by one of the defense attorneys, and he says something like, this whole mess could have been avoided if the FBI counseled individuals rather than encouraging them. And I thought, wow, it seems so simple, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, actually, I'm in Portland, Oregon right now, and there's a trial going on involving this man named Mohammed Mohammed. And, you know, that's a great example of this. This was a guy who, you know, espoused radical beliefs, that he wanted to get involved in jihad somehow, and these undercover agents came to him and said, are you interested in, you know, working on a plot with us? And he says, yes, and he talks about how he wants to bomb Pioneer Square in Portland, and the FBI agents ultimately give him everything he needs. You know, he has no money. He's about to be evicted from his apartment. The FBI gives him, I think, $3,000 to pay his back rent, so the eviction won't jeopardize the sting operation. They then provide the bomb, everything he needs. They provide the car. They provide everything. And ultimately, he moves forward in this plot. But that's an example of this kid. He was 19 at the time when the sting operation started, who probably could have just been scared out of doing something like this. Probably, you know, in the middle of the sting operation, if the FBI said, boo, we got you, you know, what are you doing here, instead of letting him carry forward with it the whole time. I don't think this is a guy who necessarily would have become a terrorist, but,
right.
You know, the FBI, through these elaborate sting operations, you know, puts, you know, goes all the way and gets them to commit these fantastical acts, you know, these acts of terrorism that, if they were real, would be horrific. But when they're able to bring them to a jury, they're just, like, so overwhelming that in most cases they're getting convictions for these cases.
Well, another side is, you know, the cozy relationship between government and the media. And one of my favorite examples in the book of how that works is the case of the Liberty City 7. What was so sketchy about the timing of that event?
Right. So, you know, this was under the administration of George W. Bush. It would have been his second term in office.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you may recall, the New York Times had written a number of stories about government overreach in spying on law-abiding citizens, using powers that were given to the Bush administration after 9/11. And, you know, one example of that, you know, you may recall one of the examples was, you know, warrantless wiretapping, being able
yes.
to listen in on conversations without a warrant. In another case, in October of 2006, the New York Times was about to release this story about how the Bush administration was also getting access to bank records without warrants, with, you know, same type of violation. And they'd worked together for days with the Bush administration saying, you know, this is the story that's coming out. The New York Times really did due diligence in telling them, this is what we have, what's your response, and this is the day it's coming out. Well, the day before that story is about to come out, the DOJ announced the prosecution, the indictment against seven guys in Liberty City, which is the poor section of Miami. And the accusation was that it was just over the top to begin with. You know, Alberto Gonzalez said that these seven guys were going to declare ground war on the United States of America, which obviously on its face is ridiculous. It's seven guys in the poor section of Miami. And
right.
then the other accusation was that they were plotting to bomb the Sears Tower in Chicago, as well as the Miami office of the FBI. And what became clear in the case early on was that these guys never had any connection to Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda connection was an undercover informant who was posing as an Al-Qaeda operative and who was offering the guys $50,000 to move forward in the plot. And yet the media, you know, immediately portrayed this as, you know, a dangerous plot. And ultimately, mm-hmm. where it was effective for the Bush administration was that by announcing it on the day it did, that pushed below the fold this very important New York Times story about the Bush administration's use of, you know, warrantless searches on bank records. And, you know, ultimately it took three trials to convict the Liberty City Seven. They only convicted five of the seven. You know, several of the guys got really short sentences. You know, I should say short, but I say that relative to terrorism right. sentences, you know, seven years or so. And these are guys that on their own never had the capacity to commit terrorism, you know, never could have without the informant gotten involved in a plot involving Al-Qaeda because they were never actually connected to Al-Qaeda. And yet the media in many ways, you know, kind of parroted exactly what the federal government wanted it to in these cases. And that's true of a lot of these terrorism cases. You know, it's true almost in every kind of crime case. You know, early on when a crime, including terrorism, is announced, the government has an efficient way of kind of controlling the narrative because that first story is often, you know, the only access to information you have comes from the
yes.
government. And for that reason, you know, the media has been very kind of lapdogish in its response to these types of cases. You know, when they're announced by DOJ, the media portrays it almost, you know, instinctually as here was another threat and it was thwarted, and thanks to like FBI agents who were vigilant, and only later, if at all, kind of comes back and says, well, wait a minute, were these guys really terrorists? Can they really be terrorists if they were never in contact with Al-Qaeda? You know, the only person who was seemingly the terrorist in it was the undercover operative who was posing as a terrorist. And I think ultimately we are seeing, you know, slowly a shift in this conversation. I'd like to think my reporting has played some role in this, but, you know, for example, like when Kwasi Nafis, the man who was accused of plotting to bomb the Federal Reserve building in New York this past October with the involvement of an undercover agent, you know, the fifth paragraph of that story was a rather meaty explanation for the New York Times of the criticism of these cases. And we weren't seeing that before. You know, the previous 6 years of these cases, we weren't seeing that type of awareness by the media. And my hope is that eventually, you know, this conversation will shift further and the media will be more aggressive in questioning the FBI and the DOJ about the efficacy of these types of cases.
Of course, yeah, you gotta hope. What's the state of the FBI's terror factory today? Do you see these practices dying down at all, like, since 9/11?
No, the really, right now, is very little incentive for the FBI to pull back on these practices. And the reason for that is really twofold. The primary reason is that this is a bureaucratic problem in some ways, as I describe in the book. You know, every year the FBI gets $3 billion to fight terrorism, and that's the largest part of its budget. That's more money than they receive for organized crime, for financial fraud, for other areas that were traditionally the focus of the FBI prior to 9/11. And so they can't every year spend $3 billion on counterterrorism and come back to Congress and say, hey guys, we spent your $3 billion and we didn't find any terrorists. You know, these sting operations are a very effective mechanism for the FBI to say, hey, we spent your $3 billion, and look what we found. Look at this terror plot. We thwarted. Look at the threat that exists. And, you know, it's that, you know, it's really a matter of kind of focusing resources on a problem and finding more problems. You know, and if you focused $3 billion of the FBI's resources in any area, you'd find, you know, all kinds of problems, depending on the area you focused on. And the other issue that's really emboldened the FBI is that they have a near-perfect record of conviction on these trials. So the only real check for the FBI in these cases is for the courts to throw them out, for there to be lots of acquittals, and that would cause a reexamination of these policies. But right now, you know, of these cases, there's a high degree of guilty pleas, given the very long sentences that come as part of the mandatory minimums. And then the other is that, you know, So far, there have been 10 defendants who have argued entrapment, and they've so far been unable to win on that defense. The 11th one, Mohammed here in Portland, his trial is ongoing, and he's also arguing entrapment. But, you know, so far, the FBI and the DOJ have, as I said, near-perfect records of conviction and have had little reason to worry that these cases will be thrown out for entrapment.
Well, like you pointed out, the FBI gets $3 billion a year to fight terrorism, and you know, there are some estimates that say that it would take about $2 billion a year to end poverty. I mean, wouldn't bringing citizens of the world up to a sustainable level of life do more to end crime and terrorism than any other possible action?
I That's a good question.
I mean, to me, if you have something to lose, you're not going to get involved in this. The people who do are poor, down on their luck. They want excitement or attention. But if everybody had, you know, the basic necessities covered, like, why would you risk that? Jail has to be worse than your life, you know? And in some cases, jail's not.
I mean, certainly the people that are caught up in these sting operations support that idea, because these are not people who are living comfortable lives with a good job and in a house with a picket fence and a family. You know, these are people very much on the fringes of society who, you know, don't have many economic resources, in most cases are very poorly educated, and just don't have a great outlook on life because of their circumstances. And, you know, that's in part why they're susceptible to this type of stuff, either, you know, for their own hatred. You know, in the case of the Newburgh Four that I mentioned earlier, you know, this guy was hateful and anti-Semitic, you know, in part because he had this life where he spent, you know, an early part of his life in jail for dealing crack cocaine. He then worked at Walmart and had very little, you know, in the way of economic power, and in so many ways had been disenfranchised. And so here you have this informant who comes to him and says, hey, I can make you a big man. Don't you want to be a big man? Like, get involved in this terror plot. And a guy like that is susceptible. But, you know, someone like you or me, someone comes to us and says, I can make you a big man, you want to get into all this terror plot, you know, we're probably saying, get out of here, and we're calling the police. But there are going to be those people who, you know, are going to be susceptible in that way, and those are the people that are really being pulled into these sting operations. You know, there was actually a judge who oversaw one of these sting trials, and I thought she had a really great quote that I quoted in the book, which is that, you know, these guys are so buffoonish that if there really were Al-Qaeda terrorists out in the United States wanting to recruit people to commit to acts of terrorism, they probably wouldn't even bothered with these guys, you know. And I think that's a great example, because these guys are buffoonish, and it's really only the FBI through these sting operations that would even care to empower someone like that to become a terrorist.
Well, to bring this forward a little bit, it seems like, you know, like with the case of the Liberty City 7, that situation, it seems like the government is in this pattern of eroding some civil liberties, getting a little more aggressive and spying. And then it raises the public's eyebrow, and then all of a sudden that action, conveniently, is justified with some foiled plot. You know, with NDAA, a lot of people are wary that government and media are pushing to blur the lines between a real terrorist and, say, a protester, or in your case, a real investigative journalist. Some journalists are really worried about that. Do you have any thoughts there?
I mean, I think as far as the definition of terrorism, I mean, one of the cases I try to make in the book is that we really have kind of bastardized and distorted this word so much. You know, these laws that were written after 9/11 and before 9/11, you know, such as the material support laws, you know, these were laws intended for people that were connected to sophisticated international organizations that had the means and the know-how to bomb a plane, for example, or bomb a building, or commit some horrific act of terrorism. But, you know, through the evolution of these cases, you know, we're describing as terrorists people that are just kind of buffoonish and on the edges of society and on their own who couldn't become terrorists. And so I think, you know, it's hard to know, you know, what a terrorist is any longer because it's been so distorted. And, you know, I think you can see the same in similar cases that aren't related to Islamic terrorism. You know, we've had a number of prosecutions involving environmental activists and people on the left. You know, the NATO Four, for example, in Chicago, or these seven guys who plotted to, you know, these so-called anarchists in Cleveland who plotted to bomb a bridge over the Cuyahoga River. You know, these were guys, you know, one of whom was mentally ill, who had no capacity on their own, and it was an informant who provided them with the bomb that they needed to set up the bridge. And, you know, we're now portraying them as terrorists. And I think what the media has done or has allowed to happen is to really abdicate to the government the role of defining what a terrorist is and who a terrorist is. So when the FBI and the DOJ bring charges and they say this man's a terrorist, the media is happily to report, you know, so-and-so accused of, you know, terrorism and, you know, a suspected terrorist and his name. And what we do see some of is a real double standard. We see, you know, for example, people charged with Islamic terrorism, people on the left, environmental activists, so-called anarchists, all being labeled as terrorists. But then, you know, when they're sovereign citizens, for example, or white supremacists, you know, involved in plots that are ultimately convicted, are only brought to court by DOJ and the FBI, we're not seeing that label applied. And, you know, I think that's what makes it even more confusing. Like how, you know, if I was brought up to testify to someone and they said, can you describe what a terrorist is today, you know, based on the last 10 years worth of terrorism prosecutions in the United States, I really would have a hard time defining that.
those type of tricks they use, I thought I saw them happening in the Occupy movement, the unfortunately brief Occupy movement, but they were infested with agent provocateurs. You'd have one masked guy throw a brick towards the cops, then all of a sudden he's gone, but 100 innocent protesters are getting tear gassed and beaten on the premise of them being violent. It makes you wonder if change can ever really come about because of this kind of manipulation.
I think in some ways what we've seen here after 9/11 and with a focus on, say, Occupy, or if you look at the sting operation involving the informant Brandon Darby with the 2008 Republican National Convention, what we've seen is a lot of money from the federal government being earmarked for counterterrorism and that flowing to the FBI as well as local law enforcement. And the truth is, there aren't a bunch of Muhammad Attas running around the United States. You know, there's no evidence to suggest that is the case. But you have millions, if not billions of dollars flowing in the effort to fight terrorism. And so what ends up happening is groups that aren't what it was necessarily targeted for ultimately become targeted for that type of surveillance, for that type of counterterrorism activity. And I think, you know, that's why we see what we see with, you know, informants being used in Occupy, with informants being used, for example, at the 2008 Republican National Convention. And I think in some ways, you know, when a bunch of counterterrorism money flows to cops, there's a suspicion among cops that, well, these people on the left, you know, they're protesters, they must be up to no good, they must be up to on the verge of some sort of violence. And I don't think it's necessarily wrong for the FBI to use informants in those groups, to use informants to get information, to, you know, to spy on them to some extent, to say, like, well, are they really interested in terrorism? But I think where the FBI has started to cross the line is by using these informants as provocateurs, as people
right.
who aren't just listening, but are saying, hey, do you want to do something? Do you want to commit some sort of act of terrorism? And I think that's what we're seeing more and more with the use of informants.
Yeah, there's just too much of a financial incentive for them. But, you know, with the increased surveillance and the erosion of privacy that we find ourselves dealing with, what do you say to someone who says, well, if you got nothing to hide, what are you so afraid of? Because I think that's the wrong attitude.
Absolutely. You know, I think this is always... There's always a tension and there's always a conflict between, you know, civil liberties and national security. So then the question is, how much are we willing to give up on the civil liberties side to feel safer on the national security side? Mm-hmm. And I would argue that we're giving up too much. You know, in some
way
ways the pendulum has swung way too much toward national security. You know, what we have now, if you look at national security under President Obama, since his first term in office, there's been an explosion of what are called warrantless electronic wiretaps or warrantless electronic surveillance, where they're going into people's email and looking for evidence of, you know, being involved in some kind of security threat. You know, under current FBI guidelines, they can open up what's called a threat assessment of anyone for 72 hours, which allows them to data mine, to go through your email, to go through your trash, to find out if there's any reason to believe you are a security threat. And they can do that without having any reason to believe that you are involved in any sort of crime. They don't need what's termed a predicate, like a reasonable belief that you are involved in criminal activity. They can, for 72 hours, just spy on you for the purpose of seeing if you are involved in terrorism. And then after 72 hours, they need that predicate. And what we're seeing is an explosion of this, of the federal government using those powers to surveil people, to look at their private information, look at their private emails, all in the name of national security. And I think what ultimately comes of this is a number of, like, blowback issues. You know, for example, that's essentially how David Petraeus went down, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, this is power so unchecked that it brought down the CIA director. And yet, you know, I think it's important for people to realize that in the, you know, kind of name of counterterrorism, we've given the government a lot of surveillance power that's being used against everyone. You know, I mean, we have fusion centers in every state that collect information from local police agencies, that collect license plate information, you know, trying to figure out where people are going. There's a growing, you know, data set that the federal government has on everyone. And I think, you know, there should be more inquiry of that, of how much privacy and how much civil liberty are we giving up in, you know, the name of you know, fighting terrorism. I mean, like, how much of our, you know, how much are we shredding the fabric of our society in the name of protecting it, so to speak?
Right. It seems like the culture is kind of going to a position where you're a suspicious person first, and then you have to prove that you're not, you know, rather than the other way around. You know,
that's definitely the case with these threat assessments, which I said are like these 72-hour periods where the FBI can, you know, basically look under every rock related to you, and all they really need is an informant, someone maybe who's a criminal himself, someone who's paid, who says, hey, you know, I heard about this guy Greg, and he's interested in committing an act of terrorism. And then that's enough for them to look at you, you know, and that's it.
Right.
You know, that isn't enough for a predicate, but it's enough
for a
threat assessment. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, now that anti-terrorism has become such an explosive economic market, do you think we'll ever see a post 9/11 world, or do you suspect that whenever people start requesting rights back, we're just going to see some government-made, narrowly escaped terror plot paraded across the media to remind us to sit down and shut up?
It's hard to know. You know, I quote Art Cummings, who was a former FBI assistant director who created the, you know, was one of the architects of the Sting programs, and you know, and I asked him about, you know, this kind of war on terrorism. How long can this go? And what the FBI believes is that, you know, we're not so much at war with Al-Qaeda as we are with what they term Al-Qaedaism, the kind of idea of Al-Qaeda. And I said to him, you know, like, well, if it's an idea, you know, you can't really kill an idea. How can you be at war with an idea?
Of course.
And he said, well, that's right. It's this indefinite war. And I think the FBI really believes this is generational, if not longer, that, you know, this is a threat to us. The fear that lone wolves in the United States will become inspired by Al-Qaeda and commit some sort of act of terrorism, and so they need to be on guard for that. But the question I raised in the book, I think, is, you know, how much have we missed as a result of this focus on counterterrorism? You know, if you look at the mortgage fraud that went on in the middle of the 2000s,
of course,
you know, mortgage fraud was an area that the FBI prior to 9/11 was cracking down on, was a big part of their business. And, you know, if they weren't so focused on counterterrorism, could we have caught some of these issues that became financial contagions in the middle of the last decade? You know, I think that's a real
right.
question, and I think that's what more people should be asking. I don't make the case, and I would never make the case that terrorism isn't a threat and that the FBI shouldn't be interested in terrorism. It should. What I do make the case for, I think, is that the priorities need to shift, and I think they need to shift back to organized crime and financial fraud and, you know, the typical things that the FBI was focused on prior to 9/11.
Yeah, 100% agree on financial fraud. I think that is the real enemy of today. It is just so unfortunate. And it's hard for people to really understand to what degree terrorism is a danger with all the manufactured stories coming out. Like, it's just hard to know. Of course, there is some guy somewhere who will want to bomb something. But, I mean, do we really need to grope everyone who goes through an airport? Because that could happen sometime somewhere. I mean, you're more likely to get in a car accident on the way to the airport, you know.
In so many ways, our counterterrorism policies, our security measures have really just been reactionary, right? You know, after the shoe bomber, everybody had to take off their shoes. And after the underwear bomber, we limited the amount of liquids that could be brought onto an airplane. And you know, how much of that is really effective, you know, I don't know. I mean,
right.
I think that is a real question, but I also think the FBI has been very good at, you know, dialing up the fear dialing up the fear a little bit
yes.
through the way it works these sting operations. You know, when it works a sting operation, it could go for a not very ambitious plot, you know, something simple. Instead, they have, you know, their targets go for extraordinary plots, like bombing skyscrapers or bombing transit systems. You know, things that are horrific and awful if they were to really occur. But I also think it's worth pointing out that, you know, it's actually quite easy to commit an act of terrorism in the United States. You know, I mean, if you wanted to commit something horrific, I mean, look at Newtown, Connecticut, right? It's one guy with a gun, an assault rifle, and some high-capacity magazines, and he commits a horrific crime. He kills 20 school children. But, you know, the truth is, in the last decade, we've seen more people killed through a lone gunman with that kind of gun violence than we have through, you know, so-called lone wolves with Al-Qaeda sympathies. You know, the truth is that we're not seeing the death toll with, you know, these so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists and lone wolves that we are seeing with just, you know, random gunmen who pick up arms.
Right. I mean, we're kind of getting down to the end of the show now, but, you know, you bring up Sandy Hook. And my opinion of government is that the conspiracy and the outright criminality, they go far deeper than even your work, but at times it often hinges on anecdotal evidence or sketchy witness testimony, so it is good to step out of that once in a while and focus on some good old-fashioned, obvious, and well-researched corruption. I loved the book. I thought the stories in it were fascinating.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Of course. Well, Trevor Aronson, thanks so much for being on the show. This is such important information to get out there. It's great that you've been brave and dedicated enough to do it. Is there any new or deeper direction your research is going to be taking you next?
No, actually, we kind of hinted on that. I mean, the next project I'd like to do, if I can turn it into a book, is to look at how a lot of this money that's been spent on counterterrorism and surveillance for counterterrorism efforts is really being turned against people and invading their privacy. You know, I think this is the next question for us. Like, what is the future of privacy in an age of terrorism? And I think that's really something I'd like to look at.
Right. I mean, that's a real concern, because it just seems like problems we have, like liquids on airplanes and taking your shoes off. When do these go away? These happen because one guy over the course of all history tried to do something and didn't get it done. You know, it does seem a little ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely, I think so much of the policy we've seen for counterterrorism and so much of the policy that ultimately creates programs that invade our privacy are just reactionary. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to some kind of threat, as opposed to being a really reason to look at what would keep us safer and how can we balance civil liberties with concerns about national security.
Well, Trevor, where can people keep up with you? Do you want to give them your website?
Yeah, my website is trevoraronson.com, and my last name is spelled with two A's, so it's Trevor, T-R-E-V-O-R, Aronson, A-A-R-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Absolutely, and I'll put a link with the episode, too. Well, that does it for me. You know, thanks again. The book is Terror Factory. Pick it up and learn something. Keep up the good work, man.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Anytime. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Well, there it is. Another Higher Side Chats in the bank. I personally see Terror Factory as a great way to reach someone who won't or can't go quite as deep as we usually do on THC. And you really don't have to look that far to see there's a real fucking problem. And that really is the point. I think Terror Factory is just perfect imagery to describe what we have going on in our government. And with that said, thank you for allowing me such an intimate place in your life for the past hour. I hope we can do it again. Please continue to share the show, leave me reviews, donate if you can, read some of the blogs by my upcoming co-host and myself that will be dropping this week, and check out the high quality and bold t-shirt designs I've come up with thus far at conspiratees.net. Here's a little dose of anti-flag to get the blood flowing again. And I'll see you on the Sabbath, people.
You gotta die, gotta die, gotta die for your government! Die for your country, that shit! You gotta die, gotta die, gotta die for your government! Die for your country, that shit!
Guinea pigs for Western Copper.